Welcome to Just for the Health of It, where we bring you new perspectives on the science of health for all. We will bring you local, state, national, and global health news. Here at Just for the Health of It, we bring you the best of both social justice and personal health. At Just for the Health of It, we focus on putting the just in Just for the Health of It. Our aim is to equip you to live healthily in a healthy community on a just planet. I am your host, Dan Rutt. I have a BS degree in biology and a master's degree in public health, specializing in nutrition. I have worked as a health educator, nutrition counselor, community health planner, and AIDS program director, not to mention dishwasher and busboy. I am a former president of the Ohio Public Health Association. This gig is one of several of my non-paying vocations, including lifelong social justice activist, political satirist, and poet. I am a longtime resident of the Old West End neighborhood in Toledo. Welcome to Just for the Health of It. Here we are, episode number 196. It's Monday, January 30th. I am recording this from an undisclosed location that looks eerily like my den. Okay, well, very brief COVID-19 update. COVID hospitalizations continue to go down, though deaths nationally are still averaging about 500 per day, the peak that we've had in the winter. Nursing home cases in Lucas County have still remained stubbornly high. There's 112 active cases right now, although the good news is we haven't had a death in a long-term care facility from COVID-19 for quite a while. That's it for COVID. Let's move on to some other stuff. This from Medical Express. Healthy lifestyle linked to slower memory decline in older adults. A healthy lifestyle, in particular a healthy diet, is associated with slower memory decline, finds a decade-long study of older adults in China published in the British Medical Journal. A healthy lifestyle score combining six factors was calculated. Healthy diet, regular exercise, active social contact such as seeing friends and family, cognitive activity such as writing, reading, playing mahjong, non-smoking, and never drinking alcohol. After accounting for a range of other health, economic, and social factors, the researchers found that each individual healthy behavior was associated with a slower-than-average decline in memory over 10 years. A healthy diet had the strongest effect on slowing memory decline, followed by cognitive activity and then physical exercise. Of the six healthy lifestyles, those with favorable, that is 4 to 6 of the six, or average lifestyles, 2 to 3 of the six, were almost 90% and almost 30% less likely to develop dementia or mild cognitive impairment relative to those with an unfavorable lifestyle, that is either 0 or only 1 of the favorable lifestyle factors. So if you have 4, 5, or 6 of those, you had almost a 90% chance less of developing dementia or mild cognitive impairment. If you had 2 or 3 of those six, you had an almost 30% less likely chance. So prevention is important given the absence of effective treatments for Alzheimer's disease and related dementias, say researchers in a linked editorial. Next up, also for Medical Express, PET imaging shows greater lung inflammation in e-cigarette users than cigarette smokers. Wow. Electronic cigarette or e-cigarette users have greater lung inflammation than cigarette smokers and non-smokers, according to a new study published online in the Journal of Nuclear Medicine. This study is the first to provide evidence that vaping e-liquids with e-cigarettes creates a unique inflammatory response in the lungs and is different from cigarette smoking. E-cigarette usage has increased dramatically in the past several years, particularly among adolescents and young adults. While many people assume that e-cigarettes are safer than conventional cigarettes, e-cigarettes can cause pulmonary inflammation and increase the risk of lung disease. In addition, their long-term safety has not been rigorously evaluated. And if you or someone you know is trying to quit tobacco or e-cigarettes, you can call the Quit Line for resources and assistance. That is 1-800-QUIT-NOW. 1-800-QUIT-NOW. Next up from the CDC, sleep medication use in adults age 18 and over in the United States 2020. So This is important because sleep is one of the foundations of health, the pillars of health. So in 2020, 8.4% of adults took sleep medication in the last 30 days, either every day or most days to help them fall or stay asleep. Now, this is including both prescription and over-the-counter methods. Although I did look up melatonin, which was one of the more popular over-the-counter, and that's only maybe a couple percent of people. So 8.4% of adults using every day or most days in the past 30 days, and an additional 10% took sleep medications on, quote, some days in the last 30 days. So total, you've got about 18.4% of the U.S. adult population that is using medication at least some of the time in the last month. Okay, next up, a story on injury prevention and the consequences. This from Medical Express. Head injury is associated with doubled mortality rate long term. Adults who suffered any head injury during a 30-year study period had two times the rate of mortality than those who did not have any head injury. And mortality rates among those with moderate or severe head injuries were nearly three times higher, according to new research from the School of Medicine at the University of Pennsylvania, published in JAMA Neurology. In the United States, over 23 million adults age 40 and older report a history of head injury with loss of consciousness. Head injury can be attributed to a number of causes, from motor vehicle crashes, unintentional falls, or sports injuries. What's more, head injury has been linked with a number of long-term health conditions, including disability, late-onset epilepsy, dementia, and stroke. This highlights the importance of safety measures, like wearing helmets and seatbelts, to prevent head injuries. When investigators evaluated specific neurologic causes of death among participants with head injury, they found that nearly two-thirds of neurologic causes of death were attributed to neurodegenerative diseases, like Alzheimer's and Parkinson's disease. These diseases compose a greater proportion of overall deaths among individuals with head injury at 14.2% versus those without head injury at 6.6%. So it's important. Another pillar of health is safety and injury prevention. So wear your seat belts, and if you're playing a sport, wear protective gear like a helmet. Next up from The Hill, mental health tops parental concerns about children, says survey. U.S. parents are most concerned about their children's mental health over other issues, according to a new survey. A Pew Research Center survey of nearly 3,800 parents with children younger than 1,800 years of age found that 4 out of 10 parents are either extremely or very worried that their kid will suffer from anxiety or depression in the future. The second highest concern among parents is about their children being bullied. Out of survey respondents, 35% said they were either extremely or very worried about their children being bullied at some point in their life. Differences among parental concerns run along racial and class lines, according to the study. White and Hispanic parents are the most likely to worry about their children's mental health. Out of all surveyed parents, 42% of white parents and 43% of Hispanic parents said they are extremely or very worried that their children might struggle with anxiety or depression. More than 30% of black parents and 28% of Asian parents said the same. Low-income parents were more likely to be concerned about their children developing mental issues or being bullied. Almost half, or 48%, of lower-income parents said they are extremely or very concerned about their children struggling with anxiety or depression and being bullied. Okay, next up, a story about stigma and how stigma and discrimination can actually add to our health problems. This from Conscien Health. Adding stigma to obesity and heart disease. For the most part, prior evidence for the health harm of weight stigma, though persuasive, was observational. Persons with a history of exposure to stigmatizing experiences are more likely to have poor health outcomes. Persons who feel stigmatized because of their weight are more likely to have persistent or progressive obesity. So this new research is important because it brings the first experimental evidence that stigmatizing experiences directly cause a worsening of heart disease symptoms in persons with obesity. It was a randomized controlled trial in women with obesity and normal or high blood pressure. Each of those women on separate occasions had exposures to neutral or stigmatizing video content. What they found was that the stigmatizing content caused an increase in blood pressure for the women with high blood pressure, but not for those with normal blood pressure. That rise in blood pressure persisted well after the exposures. During sleep hours afterward, those women had both elevated blood pressure and heart rate. The author summed it up quite clearly. To our knowledge, this is the first rigorously designed, controlled study to test whether an acute weight stigma exposure compared to a neutral exposure leads to heightened cardiovascular reactivity among women with obesity with elevated versus normal blood pressure. These findings suggest the need for healthcare providers to be educated on the harmful effects of weight stigma on patients' cardiovascular health. Heart disease is a problem, with or without obesity. Obesity causes harms all by itself, and through a large number of other diseases that result from it. On top of that, weight stigma causes further harm. With every day that passes, we have better medical options for treating obesity and heart disease. The stigma that people perpetuate, intentionally or not, is a tougher nut to crack. Okay, next up, a story with an interesting take on social determinants of health. This from Medical Express. The dangers of bureaucracy. Research demonstrates structural bias and racism in mental health organizations. Bias is embedded in the very ways healthcare organizations operate, according to a study published recently in Clinical Psychological Science. The study reveals how organizational-level biases affect how patients and even providers are viewed, and in ways that can produce racial and ethnic inequities. The authors specifically focus on mental health organizations, detailing how they may systematically transmit bias and racism through common bureaucratic processes, and in some cases through staff merely doing their job. In an equally disturbing finding, the study revealed that staff often remain unaware of this transmission process and perpetuate it simply by meeting their work requirements, a process that the authors termed bureaucracy. Over time, this can lead to care becoming system-centered rather than person-centered, let alone equitable, the researchers concluded. At the same time, while the study focused on health settings, we firmly believe that it has direct relevance for institutions and systems outside of healthcare, offering concrete evidence and novel concepts to address how inequity can flourish in very hidden ways. The study carries implications for healthcare and other organizations and suggests novel structural targets for intervention. It also signals a paradigm shift for psychological science, as it demonstrates how structural bias and racism partly depend on collective psychological processes, which psychological science has typically neglected in favor of individualist or internalist accounts. The study offers a robust scientific and practical framework to help psychology, healthcare, and related fields address structural bias and racism. Yeah, what really leaped out with that is, you know, that through staff merely doing their job. I've had a saying for quite a while that I think most of the evil in this world happens through two mechanisms. People saying, I'm just doing my job, or that's not my job. Okay, and in another story that gets at the organizational impacts on health, this from Medical Express. Average pregnancy length in the U.S. is shorter than in European countries, and this can affect your health. Maternal health outcomes continue to worsen in the United States, where maternal and infant mortality rates far exceed rates in European countries and other wealthy nations. Now, a new study led by researchers at Boston University School of Public Health and Harvard Medical School affiliated Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center is shedding insight on how hospital organizational structures and staffing within U.S. maternity care may affect the birthing process and possibly contribute to adverse birth outcomes. Published in the journal PLOS One, the study analyzed gestational age patterns and timing of home and hospital births in three high-income countries. The U.S., which embraces a maternity care model that relies heavily on obstetricians and clinical interventions, and England and the Netherlands, which primarily rely on midwives who provide low-intervention maternity care. The findings show that the average length of U.S. pregnancy steadily declined by more than half a week between 1990 and 2020, from just over 39 weeks to 38.5 weeks, and that U.S. pregnancies on average are shorter than pregnancies in England and the Netherlands. In 2020, only 23% of U.S. births occurred at 40 or more weeks, compared with 44% of births in the Netherlands and 40% of births in England. The gestational age pattern for home births was the same in all three countries. In all three countries, the researchers also examined birth timing by hour of the day for home and vaginal births at the hospital, and then repeated this analysis, limiting the comparison to hospital-based vaginal births without interventions such as induction or labor augmentation that could possibly alter the timing. In England and the Netherlands, births at home and at the hospital occurred at similar times in the day, peaking in the early morning hours between 1 a.m. and 6 a.m. Not too convenient for you ladies now, is it? But in the U.S., there was a noticeable difference in birthing timing between the two settings. Births at home peaked in the same early morning hours as home births in other countries. By contrast, hospital-based births, even those with no interventions that could affect the natural pattern of timing, largely occurred during standing working hours for clinical staff, from 8 a.m. to 5 p.m. The paper is the first international study using large data sets to compare gestational age and birth timing in three high-income countries. Most prior research has focused on data from individual hospitals or countries. Given England's and the Netherlands' superior birthing outcomes, the authors say their findings suggest the U.S. mortality care models could benefit from an organizational shift that places less emphasis on active clinical management of labor and allows the birthing process to take a natural course. Our multi-country analysis shows that the U.S. is an outlier in gestational age distribution and timing of low-intervention hospital births, says study lead author Dr. Eugene Declerc, professor of community health sciences at Boston University School of Public Health. There's a lesson to be learned from countries with more positive maternity outcomes than the U.S. in having hospital staffing and operational plans conform more closely to the natural patterns of birth timing and gestational age, rather than trying to have birth timing fit organizational needs. Every system is perfectly designed to get the results that it gets, says study senior author Dr. Nell Shaw. The alarmingly poor results of the U.S. maternal health system demand greater attention to its design. Our study shows that in comparison with other high-income countries, American hospitals may be designed to center the convenience of clinicians more than the needs of people giving birth. And next up, another article that gets to the fact that too much healthcare can be a problem and the over-medicalization of people. This from Medical Express. New recommendations say patients don't need to be, quote, checked for everything. As well-intentioned as routine blood tests or annual physicals might be, these practices can sometimes do more harm than good. To combat commonly ordered but not always necessary procedures and tests, the Society of General Internal Medicine released its revised list of recommendations on five primary care procedures and tests that patients and physicians should question. Northwestern University Dr. Jeffrey Linder and David Liss, who have previously published research on the benefits of primary care checkups, helped revise the list. For instance, the age-old idea of getting an annual physical exam with routine blood tests from a primary care doctor is a misconception because a person's age and other risk factors should primarily influence how frequently they should see their doctor. We often have patients coming in asking us to check me for everything, but this is potentially anxiety-provoking, dangerous thing for patients, because the more testing we do, the more stuff we find, and the more we need to follow up, said Linder, chief of the Division of General Internal Medicine at Northwestern University School of Medicine. In someone who is asymptomatic and, quote, abnormality, is much more likely to be a false positive or of no clinical significance than for us to catch early disease. False positives can expose patients to all the anxiety, costs, hassle, and time commitment, and danger from sometimes invasive testing, with a very low likelihood that is going to improve their health. This isn't to say nobody should get a checkup every year. For instance, patients who have overdue preventive services, rarely see their primary care physician, have low self-rated health, and or are age 65 or older should get an annual checkup, the scientist said. Time and downstream financial costs are also issues of these commonly ordered but oftentimes unnecessary tests and procedures, Dr. Liss said. Patients and care teams often spend valuable time on low-value checkups that could have been devoted to high-need patients, said Liss, research associate professor of general internal medicine. There also is the overall increasing cost to the health system, and even if annual checkups are covered by most insurance, patients often have co-pays for services like blood draws and other diagnostic tests. The revised list was developed after months of careful consideration and review. using the most current evidence about management and treatment options. Doctors Linder and List served as ad hoc members of the Society of General Internal Medicine's Choosing Wisely Working Group. Here are the five recommendations based on a review of the most recent studies in the field. 1. Don't recommend daily home glucose monitoring in patients with type 2 diabetes not using insulin. So you see all the ads for the glucose monitoring, which is ramping up people's requests for that, but they're not recommending it in all patients. 2. Don't perform routine annual checkups unless patients are likely to benefit. The frequency of checkups should be based on individual risk factors and preferences. During checkups, don't conduct comprehensive physical exams or routine lab testing. 3. Don't perform routine preoperative testing before low-risk surgical procedures. 4. Don't recommend cancer screening in adults with life expectancy of less than 10 years. And one of those in the hospital emergency room, 5. Don't place or leave in place peripherally inserted catheters for patient or provider convenience. Well, we have a lot of health care in this country, but we suffer from both over-medicalization and overuse of healthcare services, as well as underuse. And unfortunately, our overall population health indicators are worse than virtually all other so-called industrialized societies.
And now for a word from our lack of sponsors. PR Medica and Merciless Health are rated in the top 100 in clinical excellence in some category that hopefully covers the healthcare you might be able to access. Warning, such excellence may be severely limited by being delivered in the least effective and most expensive sick care system among the so-called advanced economies. While you may be privileged enough or lucky enough to get access to excellent care, your community overall is poorly served. Any such clinical excellence is best taken with a double dose of advocacy for universal health care. This program is not sponsored by PR Medica or Merciless Health. PR Medica and Merciless Health are unwholly owned subsidiaries of Tourette's Industries, ensuring that you will swear by them, whether you like it or not. And now, back to your irregular programming.
Okay, next up, a story that shows there's a lot of medical tests out there that haven't necessarily been validated that they're effective. This from ProPublica. The tests are vital, but Congress decided that regulation is not. A number of tests used by patients to make major healthcare decisions have once again escaped regulation by the Food and Drug Administration, following intense lobbying on behalf of test makers, professional associations, and academic medical centers. For years, experts have warned about the dangers of so-called laboratory-developed tests, including certain cancer screenings and diagnostic tests from everything from Lyme's disease to autism, that are reaching patients without FDA oversight. ProPublica recently published an investigation about popular prenatal screenings that fall into this category, which one expert described as an unregulated Wild West. Upwards of half of all pregnant people now receive one of these prenatal screenings. ProPublica has also put together a guide for expecting parents, and you can get that on my website by looking at this article at toppun.com/blog/WAKT. I'll repeat that later in the show. Congress was on the cusp of finally creating a pathway for the FDA to scrutinize these tests, as it does for many other common commercial tests. For much of 2022, the VALID Act seemed on track for passage, and then in the final weeks of the year, legislators backed away. The VALID Act, which had bipartisan support, had been developed after nearly a decade of debate among stakeholders about ways to close a regulatory loophole and clarify the FDA's role in overseeing the testing industry. The legislation had momentum thanks in part to Theranos fraudulent blood testing scandal and the coronavirus pandemic, both of which revealed the possible consequences of unchecked tests reaching patients. But lawmakers left VALID out of the must-pass end-of-the-year bill that dealt with a range of spending priorities. The current approach to lab-developed tests goes back to 1976, when Congress revamped the regulation of medical devices. At the time, the tests were considered low-risk and were not in wide use. Since then, the FDA has effectively exempted this type of lab test from its requirements. Today, the number and complexity of lab-developed tests has grown. A study by the Pew Charitable Trust said there's no way of knowing how many are used on patients each year because there are no tracking measures. But Pew estimated that 12,000 labs are likely to use lab-developed tests, many of which process thousands of patient samples each day. The needs were getting bigger and bigger, and also the potential risks get bigger and bigger too, said Mark McClellan, who served as the head of both the FDA and the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services during President George W. Bush's administration. He had urged Congress to pass the bill. Several people involved in bill negotiations told ProPublica that concern over how it would affect academic labs is what killed it. Here's the thing. The academic medical centers and big medical centers are in every state. They employ a lot of people and have significant impact, economic impact on every lawmaker's turf, he said. And so that gives them a pretty big voice. While some proponents of the bill still hold out hope for the VALID Act, others said it's unlikely to get traction again anytime soon. Several of those involved said they anticipate the FDA, which has long claimed jurisdiction over the tests, will try to use its current powers to take direct action, though that will likely take more time and could face litigation from opponents. While we stand ready to work with Congress, we are considering all options, an FDA press officer said in a statement. One of those options is administrative action, which could include rulemaking. Speaking at a trade conference in October, FDA Commissioner Robert Califf said that going it alone is not something we want to do because having a clear law passed leads to the best solution. But, he said, if nothing passes, we also can't stand by. Current and former FDA officials have expressed befuddlement at how difficult it's been to regulate these tests. There's almost a point of, what do I need to do? Jeff Shuren, director of the FDA Center for Devices and Radiological Health, said to a trade journal in October, do I need a pile of dead bodies before somebody says enough is enough? Okay, well, next I have a very important article that may seem kind of boring or not sexy because it has to deal with data collection. But, of course, in public health, there are three core functions: assessment, assurance, and policy development. And assessment comes first for a reason, because if you can't define a problem, you probably can't solve it, and you may not even know about it. This from Stat News. Death by missing data. Uncollected racial and ethnic pandemic data will drive inequities for decades to come. At every stage of the COVID-19 pandemic, national reporting of racial and ethnic disparities in COVID-19 testing, diagnosis, disease severity, treatment, and vaccination by clinicians, public health organizations, and the media has been marred by frustrating data deficiencies. How bad has the problem been? Far beyond bad. In epidemiology research, missing more than 5% of data in a category is significant because, at that level, the missing data could no longer be treated as statistically random, which makes findings gleaned from the analysis becoming suspect. A whopping 56% of confirmed COVID-19 infections were missing race and ethnicity when first reported in July 2020. That's only months into the pandemic. In a systematic review published in 2021, researchers had to exclude one-fifth of cross-sectional studies looking at COVID-19 disparities because data on race ethnicity was missing for more than 20% of cases. Alarms about the lack of demographic data for COVID-19 cases and deaths have been sounded over and over by physicians, scientists, and advocates since early 2020. Shocked to find that more than half of race or ethnicity data for confirmed COVID-19 infections were missing nationally, even months into the pandemic, many took to the media to articulate just how dangerous this was. Seeking something better, volunteers scrambled to take up the mantle. Concerned civilians, worried scientists, private entities, and journalists struggled to fill the data vacuum. Despite urgent advocacy, published everywhere from the most prestigious academic journals to multiple media outlets, not much improved. During the first phase of the rollout of COVID-19 vaccines, from mid-December 2020 to mid-January 2021, race ethnicity data were still missing in more than 40% of reported U.S. COVID-19 cases. Epidemiology requires good data. Without it, epidemiologists can't build an understanding of a disease spread and impact. Public health experts can't control or mitigate how it unfurls, and health policy professionals can't formulate effective plans to address the crisis. COVID-19 cuts along social lines. Though the virus was once theorized to be the great equalizer, it could take anyone down no matter how young or rich, that myth was quickly busted. The lines of the disease carved deep into the lives of vulnerable populations to cause unequal pandemic suffering, hitting hard as those who have not. Of course, those of you who followed public health for a long time know that these inequities drive virtually all public health problems, and it's not surprising at all. As a group of health equity scholars, we and our colleagues knew that a better understanding of how historical inequities might tie to contemporary COVID-19 disparities and could help inform solutions that protect everyone. For months, we discussed the right way to study the through lines between government-sponsored segregation, neighborhood disinvestment, and the higher rates of COVID-19 being seen in Black and Brown Americans. Across country lines, time zones, and disciplines, we tinkered with our research question again and again. We didn't complete the project. We couldn't, because we found that even in 2022, the degree of missing data on race and ethnicity in federal COVID-19 databases was still simply too high. In a national data set of more than 50 million COVID-19 cases assembled by the CDC, more than 17 million did not have race ethnicity data. That's 34% of cases. By comparison, just 1% of cases were missing data on age and sex. Since we were stymied from pursuing our original research questions, we pivoted to investigate the completeness of racial ethnic data over the course of the pandemic. After obtaining de-identified patient-level data from the CDC's National Case Surveillance, which includes all COVID-19 cases and associated demographic characteristics shared with the CDC, we mapped the missingness of racial and ethnic data by state over time to see if data collection and reporting improved with lessons learned throughout the pandemic. They didn't. 3 years into the pandemic, the degree to which data on race or ethnicity are still missing is shameful, though with large variation in the degree of missing data between states. Across the nation, from 2020 to 2022, data on race and ethnicity were missing from 34% of all reported COVID-19 diagnoses. There was substantial variability from state to state, ranging from 9% missing race ethnicity in Utah to 100% missing in North Dakota. Visualized by county, there was also significant variability within states as well. Reporting about COVID-19-related deaths was slightly better, with 15% of reports overall missing race ethnicity data. Yet, egregious limitations remained. Three states, North Dakota, South Dakota, and West Virginia, provided zero data on deaths by race or ethnicity to the CDC. These states, whose populations are more than 80% white, were ill-equipped to fully understand which of their residents were dying of COVID-19. One study from Fulton County, Georgia, found that even conservative adjustments for statistical bias associated with missing race and ethnicity data increased the incidence of COVID-19 by 130% for Black people, 170% for Hispanic people, and 160% for other, including Indigenous, Native, Hawaiian, and Pacific Islander people. In other words, the degree of missing data significantly skews conclusions about who is affected by COVID-19. Unadjusted and incomplete data risks significantly lowballing the magnitude of inequities. The pervasive missingness of racial and ethnic data amounts to nothing short of data genocide. This categorical erasure of viral transmission networks, lives lost, and missed vaccination opportunities in data collected from Black, Hispanic, Asian, and Indigenous communities represents a dismissal that may reverberate inequities for generations to come. Deficient data collection early in the pandemic might have been excusable, though proper public health preparedness could have been more robust. It's understandable that the epidemic's initial tidal wave of upheaval led to inadequate documentation and record gathering, but that explanation has expired. In fact, the missingness of COVID data reported in early 2022 was worse than ever. Hospitals, healthcare providers, and laboratories route public health surveillance data to the CDC via local, state, territorial, and tribal public health agencies. Federal mandates requiring the collection and reporting of basic data on race, age, sex, and zip code were in place as early as August 2020. It's clear they haven't worked for race and ethnicity. Knowing basic population-level information about COVID-19 is vital, especially amid rationed care contexts. When scarce resources must be allocated to communities at greatest risk, the ability to slow disease spread and redress inequity depends on the ability to effectively target interventions. Vulnerable Americans have felt this intimately and painfully. An inability to calculate socio-demographic disparities is a fundamental obstacle to health equity. And, as the pandemic has clearly shown, concentrated harms facing marginalized populations inevitably spill over to affect the whole of society. Surveillance of acute viral pandemics and chronic diseases alike is essential, but public health decision-making cannot remain tethered to strained data supply chains. The CDC recently announced an agency-wide structural overhaul, including the creation of an Office of Health Equity and an Office of Public Health Data Surveillance and Technology to advance the agency's plan to, quote, build the data infrastructure necessary to connect all levels of public health with the critical data needed for action. Creating robust alternatives need not start from scratch. In Minnesota, a new cross-sector partnership produced near-complete weekly data on the pandemic's impact across a plethora of socio-demographic characteristics, including race, ethnicity, homelessness, and incarceration, as well as geospatial rurality and social vulnerability indices. This initiative required a concerted effort to coalesce the state's largest health systems, community-based organizations, public health stakeholders, and government agencies for homelessness and criminal justice. Models like the Minnesota Electronic Health Record Consortium can serve as a nidus for reforming hyperlocal collection and reporting of comprehensive sociodemographic data and for real-time monitoring of public health interventions. So I want to stop and make an editorial note. Can serve as a nidus. That's a new word for me. I consider myself pretty literate. Apparently, a nidus is a focal point and considered like a nesting area. A brooding nest, for instance, is a nidus, N-I-D-U-S. So there's your vocab word for the day. The pervasiveness of missing data on who gets COVID-19 and who dies from it is a troubling public health failure. 3 years into this pandemic, the fact that federal data still cannot confidently describe the current global priority says something about our nation's capacity for public health. It also speaks to our country's ability to emerge from this crisis and brace itself for the next one. Well, you are listening to Just for the Health of It on WAKT 106.1 FM Toledo, We Act Radio. Just for the Health of It is the People's School of Public Health in the University of Life. And I give you this guarantee, if you listen to this show for 1 year, you will know more about public health than 99% of the population. Although that may be a low bar to set. Okay, for you data freaks who may want to look at some local health data, you can go to Congressional Health District Health Dashboard.org. Congressional Health District Dashboard.org. And you can explore a health snapshot of your congressional district. They have 36 measures of community health. And for Congressional District Ohio 9, which includes Toledo, of those 36 measures, 12 were worse than the U.S. average, and only one was better. The one that was better was about those spending greater than 30% of their income on rent, which was 39% of the population. So, hey, the cost of living is lower in Congressional District 9. That's good to know. But in general, it's a lot worse. You look at a couple of overall measures, life expectancy is 1.2 years shorter in the Congressional District Ohio 9, including Toledo, than the U.S. average. And this is about 20% more years of potential life lost before age 75 than the U.S. as a whole. Okay, for some more Ohio data, you can go to groundworkohio.org/dashboard. That's groundworkohio.org/dashboard. And there's an early childhood dashboard, which has a lot of interesting data. But I really just wanted to highlight one fact. And unfortunately, this is not a particularly good one for Ohio, as is often the case. Family resiliency is defined as talking together about what to do, working together to solve problems, families knowing they have strengths to draw on, and staying hopeful, even in difficult times. Most Ohio parents with young children report that their families are resilient. Yet, Ohio ranks 50th in the nation for family resilience. I'm going to say that again. Ohio ranks 50th in the nation for family resilience. Our families are sending a message to our systems that despite their best problem-solving strength and hope, They are carrying the weight of policy and system failures. And I also wanted to note the kind of naive optimism that's often taken by some advocates. The next sentence of this, and actually the head of the heading of this section that reports this ranking, it says, and this is bolded, while Ohio families are strong, then it continues, policies, programs, and systems must do a better job supporting the families we need it most. So if you're saying that we rank 50th out of 50 states, and we're going to say that Ohio families are strong, I don't know. What would it take to have weak families? It's kind of a weird denial, I think. I'm glad that they're focusing on the fact that we need a better job supporting the families we need, which has to do with policy and system failures. But for goodness sakes, families that are beaten down can actually have low resiliency. So, Ohio ranked 50th in family resiliency. May we continue to do better than that. Of course, there's only one way up. Not that we couldn't get worse, but I think the 50th ranking can only be improved upon. Okay, well, another story that may be a little bit public health geeky. We're doing a good run this show. This from the director's blog of NIH, a rare public health challenge. Most public health challenges may seem obvious. The COVID-19 pandemic, for example, swept the globe and in some way touched the lives of everyone. But not all public health challenges are as readily apparent. Rare diseases are a case in point. While individually each disease is rare, collectively rare diseases are common. More than 10,000 rare diseases affect nearly 400 million people worldwide. In the United States, the prevalence of rare diseases, over 30 million people, that's almost 10% of the population, rivals or exceeds that of common diseases such as diabetes with 37 million Americans, Alzheimer's disease with almost 7 million people, and heart failure of about 6 million people. As with common diseases, the personal and economic burdens of rare diseases are immense. People who live with rare diseases often struggle for years before they receive an accurate diagnosis, with some remaining undiagnosed for a decade or longer. The diagnostic odyssey includes countless doctor visits, unnecessary tests and procedures, and wrong diagnoses. For people in rural and low-income communities, lack of access to care is an additional barrier to an accurate diagnosis. And a diagnosis often doesn't lead to better health. Only about 5% of rare diseases have a U.S. FDA-approved treatment. Collectively, the personal burdens of those with rare diseases impose a significant economic cost on the nation. When quantifying the healthcare expenses for people with rare diseases, we found that they have 3 to 5 times greater costs than those without rare diseases. In the United States, the total direct medical costs for those with rare diseases is approximately $400 billion annually, a figure validated independently by the Every Life Foundation for Rare Diseases. The Every Life study also included indirect and non-medical costs, resulting in a higher total economic burden of nearly $1 trillion annually. What's even starker is that the true scope and impact of rare diseases actually may be greater because rare diseases aren't easily visible in our healthcare system. Many of the diseases are too rare to have a code that identifies them in the electronic health record, where, of course, a lot of researchers look. Okay, well, while that's some bad news on rare diseases, I want to end the regular reporting this show on some better news, and this is eliminating neglected diseases in Africa. There are good reasons for hope. This from Medical Express. Togo had reason to celebrate in 2022 when it became the first country in the world to eliminate 4 neglected tropical diseases. The West African nation stamped out Guinea worm disease in 2011, lymphatic filariasis in 2017, sleeping sickness in 2020, and trachoma last year. These diseases are transmitted in various ways. Guinea worm disease, for instance, is waterborne, while sleeping sickness is transmitted by the tsetse fly. They are just a few among a host of neglected tropical diseases, which mostly affect impoverished communities and are exacerbated by instability, climate change, and poor living conditions. Every year, 1.7 billion people are affected by these diseases. They cause immense suffering, stigma, disability, and sometimes death. Togo achieved its milestone through a combination of measures. These included door-to-door mass drug administration, training of healthcare staff, sustained financing, and strong political support. Other African countries have made significant progress in tackling neglected tropical diseases in 2022. Benin, Rwanda, and Uganda managed to eliminate sleeping sickness. Malawi eliminated trachoma, and the Democratic Republic of Congo eliminated guinea worm disease. In another continent, in India, Prime Minister Narendra Modi applauded his country's success in eliminating smallpox, polio, and guinea worm disease, while expressing confidence that it could soon eliminate another neglected tropical disease, visceral leishmaniasis. All of this means there's plenty of reason to celebrate, but the global health community cannot rest on its laurels. These diseases are still present in many areas. The insects that transmit many of these diseases don't respect borders, so no one is safe until everyone is. The COVID-19 pandemic gravely disrupted control programs, delaying the achievement of elimination goals by years for some diseases. Some countries are also struggling to tackle neglected tropical diseases because of instability and conflicts that hinder control efforts, or because they have a large remote regions that are difficult to reach. Adequate funding is needed to support drug distribution, training of healthcare staff, and raising awareness. Funding for research and development is critical, too, so that the promising innovations emerging from African laboratories and clinical trial sites can reach doctors and patients. One of the challenges in tackling many neglected tropical diseases is the absence of adequate treatments. Existing medicines are often not effective enough or are difficult to administer, such as regular injections that require hospitalization. Some treatments are very painful. Others are downright toxic. For some diseases, such as a fungal infection called mycetoma, which is endemic in Sudan, there are no effective treatments at all. Amputation is often the only option. Because these diseases affect the poorest communities and there is little profit to be made from developing new drugs, they have been historically ignored by traditional pharmaceutical research. But the abundance of good news last year has given me hope. 2022 was an incredible year for visceral leishmaniasis, which is endemic in Eastern Africa and is my field of expertise as a physician and specialist in infectious diseases and tropical medicine. The disease is fatal if left untreated. It's the deadliest parasitic killer after malaria. Those infected with visceral leishmaniasis suffer from fever, weight loss, and intense fatigue. Many are unable to work, which means a loss of income for their families. But in September 2022, a shorter, more effective new treatment was announced. Developed with several partners, including Doctors Without Borders, this treatment partially removes the need for daily injections. In June, the World Health Organization also recommended an improved treatment specifically for people who are co-infected with HIV and visceral leishmaniasis. This gives hope for the thousands of patients, often young seasonal migrant workers, who respond poorly to standard treatment. Promising results for a new one-drug dose for sleeping sickness were also announced last year, following clinical studies conducted in the Congo and Guinea by Congolese and Guinean researchers. This new medicine would be a significant improvement over existing drugs and could open the door to sustainably eliminating the disease. This is a remarkable achievement. I still remember when the only drug available to my fellow doctors in the Congo was an arsenic derivative so toxic it killed 5% of their patients. However, research and development efforts alone are not enough. Collaboration and partnerships are key. These are not just buzzwords. Past successes in tackling neglected tropical diseases have been rooted in close-knit partnerships between national health authorities, international donors, medical research institutes, universities, and industry. The new treatments I mentioned above were all developed thanks to such coalitions. I am the director of the Eastern African Office of the global nonprofit medical research organization called Drugs for Neglected Diseases Initiative, which took an active role in all these research and development collaborations. The good news is that new partnerships keep being formed. In 2022, we established Leish Access, a regional collaboration in Eastern Africa working to promote access to visceral leishmaniasis treatments and remove the obstacles that still prevent half of patients from accessing the life-saving drugs they need. All these advances give me hope. These extraordinary efforts will eventually pay off. I am convinced that in a not-so-distant future, people will stop dying from leishmaniasis and will be safely cured thanks to simple oral drugs. Many gaps remain, with millions of people still suffering from diseases that could be cured, and neglected tropical diseases that are slowly disappearing can suddenly come back with a vengeance, fueled by conflicts, economic crises, increased poverty, or climate change. But if sustained investment is coupled with African political leadership and scientific excellence, there's good reason to hope for the elimination of neglected tropical diseases on the continent. Well, this story brings back memories of my public health training in graduate school, and I remember the scariest course by far that I ever took was the epidemiology of infectious diseases in the developing world. It made me want to never leave this country again. But of course, most people in the world live outside this country in the developing world. Okay, well, next up, the segment called Bonus Articles, a carefully curated combination of headlines you can use and long reads for increased enrichment, available online, just like all the stories I've reported on in this episode. I'll give the link at the end of the list. 19 bonus articles this week. First up, annual COVID-19 booster, the FDA Cliff Notes. These first two are from one of my favorite, the My Local Epidemiologist blog. So if you're interested in the wranglings that the FDA is about thinking about turning COVID-19 into something more of a routine annual flu shot, this will give you some insight into that. And another interesting one about infectious disease, but isn't directly affected humans, is bonus article number two, Why Are There No Eggs? Avian Flu and Keeping Human Risk Low. So a lot of birds have died because of the avian flu, but fortunately not that many humans. You can transfer to humans, but it's pretty difficult. But, of course, with mutations and such, there's always a chance and want to keep that risk low for humans. Bonus article three, mass shootings can be contagious, research shows. One of the most interesting things about this is that 80% of mass shooters are actively suicidal just prior to the shooting. So it's really more accurate really to look at mass shooters rather than committing mass murder. It's really mass murder and suicide. And the fact that most of them actually have no plan and often just kill themselves if they're not killed in encounters with police. The kind of active suicide. Okay, bonus article four. Many Americans don't know basic abortion facts. Test your knowledge. So this is based on some national survey data where they ask people all basic abortion facts, and the fact is we're not that educated. You'd think that something of such public interest, we'd be better informed, but that's not necessarily the case. And bonus article five, another abortion article. This one, abortion out of reach. The exacerbation of wealth disparities after Dobbs. So this is a good summary of the fact that abortion is profoundly different based on your wealth status or lack thereof. In fact, women who are below 200% of the poverty rate have a 6 times greater abortion rate than those above 200% of poverty. And of course, that's if you can get an abortion. That's why the abortion out of reach title is there, is because those people that are lower income obviously have a much harder time getting access to abortion, particularly after Roe fell. And bonus article six is a follow-up to a story that I reported on a couple times before, and this is a good summary of the current efforts on this. A global rush is on to reduce cow burps. How can you miss that story? And help save the world from climate change. So livestock are a big source of greenhouse gases, and a lot of that is actually cow burps. And there are different ways to try to reduce that they're exploring. Okay, bonus article seven is actually three articles. It's a three-part series on the industry playbook, and this is regarding food and nutrition. Part one, how food companies distort nutrition science. Part two is amplifiers of bad science. And part three is getting nutrition science right. And in more industry playbook, bonus article eight from another what's apparently becoming a culture war, in the fight over gas stoves, meet the industry's go-to scientists. So industry can always find one scientist to send around the country to testify that we don't really know whether something's dangerous, et cetera, think tobacco companies. Bonus article nine, Medicare Part D plan prices may change unexpectedly, and Part D is the drug prescription plan. And prices can change unexpectedly and lead to a lot of extra costs and make it virtually impossible to actually predict your costs in many cases. Another drug company story, bonus article 10. How a drug company raked in $114 billion by gaming the U.S. patent system. You know all those Humira ads? Well, that's from AbbVie. That's it. Bonus article 11. A dangerous loophole for drug ads needs to be closed. So years ago, when FDA there was legislation around drug ads, it was really about those that were primarily, you know, in the manufacture and distribution of drugs. But there's a lot of other companies that are getting in on it that don't fit that category. And it's a huge loophole where they can have misleading ads and get away with it. There's no FDA oversight. And another FDA story, bonus article 12. After nearly 4 years of deliberation, FDA punts on how to regulate CBD. So part of the problem here is that CBD is actually been approved for limited use as a drug, but all other FDA rules require that you can't just add an FDA-approved drug to food. So basically the FDA is asking Congress to clarify this through legislation. 13, CDC makes biggest agency changes yet. This actually looks pretty good, quite a bit of a streamlining. So if you want to dig into that, there's a good story on that. Bonus article 14, wave of rural nursing home closures grows amid staffing crunch. So with labor costs going up and most of nursing homes being funded through Medicaid, which has relatively low reimbursement rates and is not growing as fast as inflation, rural areas in particular are having a hard time keeping staff. And they often reduce, they may have enough beds, but they don't have enough staff. So you have to reduce the number of beds that they can offer. And of course, some of them just go out of business. Article 15, what will it take to give babies a phthalate-free start to the in the world? And this is specifically about neonatal ICUs, because in hospitals, all those tubes, phthalates are used to make them more pliable, more flexible. And this is used a lot in neonatal intensive care units. Now, the thing is, this doesn't happen in Europe, for instance. There are alternative ways to do it, but we don't regulate it. So it's pretty much impossible in this country for neonatal ICUs to have a phthalate-free environment. Article 16, I'm going to do a series here that might be more relevant to personal health for many people. Article 16, midlife obesity linked to heightened frailty risk in older age. And this is particularly important because a lot of times there's kind of this myth that having a little extra weight actually helps you in older age, you know, because when people get frail, they tend to lose weight and that type of thing. But actually, if you look in midlife, people that are obese, this is actually linked to a definite heightened risk of frailty in older age. Article 17, intensive blood pressure control may lower risk for cognitive problems in more people. Now, we definitely know that lowering blood pressure is good for preventing cognitive problems, but the in more people is that they thought before they weren't really certain whether people who had a high systolic, that's the top number, and had an average or low diastolic, that doing intensive blood pressure control might create some other risks, but apparently that's not the case. So blood pressure control, very good for preventing cognitive problems. The last two on mental health and psychiatry. Article 18, antidepressants blunt emotions and cause sexual dysfunction. This has been known for a long time, but there's been a really interesting, good controlled study that actually gave antidepressants to people who weren't depressed and then looked what it did to them, and it actually causes a lot of the things that, you know, most psychiatrists just say, oh, that's the pre-existing depression that's causing that, when in fact it's the drug. And 19, this is actually one article, but it's going to be a whole series. Critical Psychiatry Textbook, Chapter 1, Why a Critical Textbook of Psychiatry. This is for one of my favorite sites on mental health, MAD in America. And while this is chapter one, every week they're going to serially publish another chapter of this textbook. So you can get that and all these other stories at toppun.com/blog/WAKT. That's toppun.com/blog/WAKT. Thank you for spending this hour with me, my second most favorite hour of the week. I'll be signing off now from the Jon Snow Memorial Studio. Jon Snow is considered the father of epidemiology, the science of public health. He studied infectious waterborne cholera outbreaks in London and famously persuaded local officials in 1854 to remove a pump handle from the infectious well that he had tracked down as the source. The cholera outbreak ended, and emerging germ theory took a quantum leap forward in battling the then leading causes of death, infectious diseases. May his passion and scientific tenaciousness continue to inspire us all today. Here at WAKT, We Act Radio, passion is an essential ingredient to our life. And while scientific assessment is key to public health success, passion is as much a touchstone to success in living well as anything. So, I will close with a quote from the Reverend Dr. Howard Thurman. Don't ask what the world needs. Ask what makes you come alive and go do it. Because what the world needs is people who have come alive. And on that note, let's take it home with Emma's Revolution. Check them out. I need some justice.